Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Coe.
I'm Heather Mackett.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Agnew.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Stone from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yep.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. Probably our last one for 2016, and we hope you'll stay with us. We're going to be talking a little bit about golf on this show because we have a guest in Nathan Caddack who's going to talk about the World Super Sixes, which is taking place for the first time. It's a world first here in Perth, the 16th to the 19th of February. But there's plenty to talk about in sport at the moment, and looking forward to discussing that on this podcast. I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
Well, John, there's been plenty happening in the world of sport, and I have to say, much of it has been fairly controversial of late, which we love a little bit of controversy.
Oh, you got to love controversy, and especially when it's sugar-based.
Absolutely. Well, funny you mention that. I think we'll start with that one first. And we, of course, are turning our attention to the world of cricket, and it's been labelled Lollygate.
Lollygate. Yeah, I think if it was in Australia without South Africans, we'd be calling it Sun Cream Gate. Because that's what Australians do, let's face it. We wear sunscreen because it's hot. We rub the ball with sunscreen. In other countries, it's cold, so they chew sticky lollies. You can't chew a sticky lolly out in the middle of an Australian cricket field. You soon find out how friendly the flies are. So it's just a cultural thing.
Do you think this story's been a big beat-up? Personally, I do.
Yeah, to a degree. Shining the ball, it's a hard one when it comes to, you know, what you can rub and what you can't rub on balls or whatever, because you're sweating. You know, one day we'll find out that if you eat 20 kilos of bloody jubes before the game, the sugar comes out and you sweat and you get an effect off that or something. When people are actually taking steps to damage the seam or damage the ball, that's ball tampering.
Yeah, my view is I think that there's several issues here. I think one is if we look at Test cricket, the wickets have become so in favour of batting teams is one. I think two, the bat technology now, that the bat is so dominant over the ball, probably 9 times out of 10. And then the third thing is if you look at the bowlers of today, they're not taught how to swing a ball, how to make the ball move and get the best out of a ball. All they're told to do is run in, have the shine on one side and hit the seam. And I think that is another thing. So the bowlers are at a huge disadvantage. I also question whether ball technology, so the actual ball lasting as long as it used to when it's being clubbed by these bats that are now there and on a road of a wicket, are they lasting as long as they did? And is that why bowlers are feeling they need to do this? I mean, let's be honest, though, as you touched on there, people have been finding ways to shine the ball for a long time. Absolutely. I know one particular bowler who had a fly repellent that he put on his forehead. He then found that when he mixed that with his sweat, put it on the ball, it was like, wow. You know, the shine I'm getting because of the ointment that was in the fly repellent, and that was never picked up, and he used that, and I know that for a fact. So, you know, it's been going on. The crazy thing is, and I actually think the South African cricket board had a point when they turned to Dave Richardson and went, hey, mate, you know, you were playing for our team, and you were part of that whole thing when you were a player, so don't throw the mud at us. And I think that the ICC have opened a can of worms, because where do you draw the line now? As you say, do you stop people wearing sunscreen? Do you stop them chewing gum? What are you going to do? I mean, to me, getting a shine on the ball is not a big deal. If they're picking the seam, trying to raise the seam up so that they get more deviation when it hits the seam, that is ball tampering. Or if they're scuffing one side of the ball with, as we've seen in the past, a bottle top, a piece of
glass,
or using studs. Well, that's what
De Plessis got. On his zipper. His pants zipper. They got him for rubbing it on his, you know.
Yeah.
That ball tampering.
Now, that to me is far more an infringement of the spirit of the game than actually trying to get the shine on the ball.
2 points. Number one, has there ever been a study on the effectiveness of using creams or anything like that on the swing of the ball?
Well, I did read one thing actually out of the UK, because let's not forget, Virat Kohli was photographed the day before the start of the last test doing exactly the same thing in the UK. And it said in the UK that as so far, there has been absolutely no proof that sucking a lolly and using the saliva from that actually enhances the shine on a ball.
Yeah, I'm skeptical that it works full stop.
No, I...
Oh, because once the lacquer goes off the ball, it doesn't matter what you rub into it. It just soaks in. It doesn't actually shine. It makes it look darker. It doesn't shine it. Once that outside lacquer goes off the ball, so it's only going to be effective while the ball's new anyway. New balls swing anyway, so it'd be very difficult to figure out whether there's any effectiveness in these methods or not.
Yep, absolutely. And maybe the ICC should do a study to then prove their case that it is, in fact, tampering.
And what does it say about your bowlers? As the captain, I don't trust my bowlers. I don't think my bowlers can do it. That's what it says. If I'm the bowler, that's what it says to me. My captain doesn't trust my skills as a bowler. He has to fiddle with the ball to try and make it move more because he doesn't believe I have the skills as a bowler.
Well, the funny thing is, when I played, I mean, you see it now that teams have an official ball shiner, that the ball is thrown to him to shine the ball. And he's probably the one sucking the lolly, got the most sunscreen, fly repellent. Yeah, he's probably got everything on his body. But when I was a bowler, I actually wanted the ball to come back to me as quickly as possible so I could shine it. Because I'll tell you, when I played over here, and okay, you know, I didn't play, I played whacker second grade many, many years ago. I got really frustrated that the fielders would shine both sides of the ball.
Yes.
And you're like, what the hell are you doing? We only want one side of the ball to be shined. The more dark the other one gets, the better it is. You know?
And it doesn't matter when you stand out. Maybe at test cricket level it's different, but, you know, park cricket, etc. You know, you stand there at the beginning of your bowling innings and the captain goes, right, we're going to shine the kookaburra side. And within 5 minutes, blokes are just shining, they're shining the seam.
Well, here's a radical thought, again, as you touch on that. If, as we're saying, the ball technology has fallen a long way behind and the ball is not lasting the 60 or 90 overs it's meant to last, how about we have new balls quicker? So, like tennis, you go, after a certain period, new balls, please, and a new ball comes out.
Well, in the last few years, we've seen balls disappearing after 10, 15 overs.
Yeah.
Less sometimes. And so there's obviously been an issue there, whether it is the state of the bats, etc. It's hard to know. I personally believe that one of the reasons our bowlers aren't able to perform the way we like them to is because we have coaching that instructs them not to, and we have pitchers that encourage them not to. So much one-day cricket now. Bowlers are having it line, on the spot, blah, blah. They're not given the opportunity to learn how to swing the ball. They're not given runs to play with to learn how to swing the ball. They're told from 17, younger even, no, you've got to be pitching the ball here, and it's got to be doing this, because in one-day cricket, rah, 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 rah.
Well, which bowler was it who was in the lead-up, was it to this last test, or it may have been the second test, was playing for his state team?
Stark.
And they were told he wasn't allowed to bowl more than X amount of overs.
He bowled in the first innings and they withdrew him, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that is ludicrous.
It is ludicrous, except for the fact that...
But he's playing a game. He's representing.
I get that. They should
you
never
can't muck
him.
Around with it. If the captain wants him to bowl, he bowls. If he doesn't, otherwise he doesn't play in the game. Full stop.
Yeah.
You know, it's making a mockery of the Sheffield Shield competition.
I can understand why they didn't want Stark to do the work of a whole Sheffield Shield
game. I can understand
game,
but at the same
like
time,
they shouldn't have picked him.
Yeah. At the same time, though, was it Stuart Clark and also Damien Fleming is going, the reason the bowlers are breaking down is they're not bowling enough overs in Sheffield Shield cricket to build up that strength so that their body can do it at test standard.
And every time a young bowler comes along and takes a fifer in Shield, they throw him into a test side and they break down in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big problems for Australian cricket at the moment is our good bowlers keep breaking down.
Yeah, well, you know as well, in one-day cricket, I've always said the one rule I would like changed is no limit on the amount of overs bowled by a bowler, because I think that would change one-day cricket incredibly, because if you have a bowler who can tie down one end, why can't he bowl more than 10 or 12 overs? Let him bowl out.
Well, remember when Mick Malone was playing, and they used to bowl him out, they'd bowl his 10 out at the beginning of the game, and he'd get none for 15 off his 10 overs or something like that. Why wouldn't you want to bring him back on in the last five or six overs? There you go, Mick.
Absolutely.
You know, bowl another three maidens.
Yeah, and I mean, what I think people undermine is, okay, pinning a batsman down, there is a skill in that. Stopping them scoring, being tight and not giving them a half volley or a short ball outside off stump because you're tired. There's a mental fitness and there's a physical fitness. And, you know, Mike Hendrick was another one for England that was unbelievable. And the famous one, of course, was when he hit Kim Hughes in the box. Kim Hughes went down, that was in Lords. I think it might even have been the centenary test when... he had an outstanding game, Kim Hughes. I was actually there. It was one of the best live innings I've ever seen. And there was a big delay. Kim Hughes gets to his feet and hit him in the box the next ball. And Richie Benner goes, "That's what I call accurate bowling."
And I think also, too, bowlers these days aren't taught to take wickets. They're taught not to concede runs. And it's almost as if coaches now are coaching these bowlers to... let the batsman get himself out. Just bowl a tight line, bowl here, blah, 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 and the batsman will get themselves out eventually. It doesn't work like that, especially not at test cricket level. You've got to, as Shane Warne says, you've got to give to get something. And whether that's a few runs here or a few runs there, that's what you've got to do. And pitch it up. Let the guy cover drive you. Try and get the swing. And things will fall your way. But at the moment... it's just so dogmatically geared to one day in 2020 cricket.
Well, just to wrap this up, John, I think the ICC is missing a trick here. I think that if they were clever, they could have certain lollies that are approved to be sucked by players, and it's a great sponsorship deal for the players. So it can be the ICC-approved lolly, and the players can only use those.
Sugar-free.
Yeah, whatever. You know.
Hi, I'm Mark Leduca, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, moving on from that, John, I want to turn my attention to hockey and the Junior World Cup. And it was very sad to hear that, again, we've got an international tournament where a team that has earned the right to compete at the Junior World Cup is now being denied that opportunity because of off-field issues. And that is Pakistan. They've been replaced by Malaysia. And the reasons were that apparently they hadn't confirmed their accommodation, the Pakistan Hockey Federation, and they hadn't got their visas to travel to India. Now, I think the FIH was in a very, very difficult position in that we don't know whether they've actually gone to the Indian consulate and said, you know, look, why haven't their visas been issued yet? They may well have done that. They haven't revealed that, and I have no information on that. But, you know, they have a contractual obligation to broadcasters that they're going to have a 16-team tournament. The tournament is due to start probably when this show goes to air. Can they wait that they're going to get them at the last minute? And then have 15, or if they don't get them, they've got a 15-team tournament. So it's very difficult, but incredibly, obviously, somehow, Malaysia is going to be able to get their visas at such short notice.
Well, yeah, that's what when you first mentioned this story to me, how are the Malaysians going to get there? Where are they going to stay? Where's their confirmed accommodation? Now, the Pakistanis can hardly confirm their accommodation if they haven't got their visas yet, can they?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real catch-22 situation.
Well, it stinks. It really does stink. And it goes back to that old rivalry, really, doesn't it? There's obviously some people within the Indian government or within world hockey of Indian background who just don't like Pakistan.
I just find it really sad because, to me, it's incredibly short-sighted in that, yes, Pakistan's senior team is struggling. They've not qualified for the World Cup for the first time. They failed to qualify for the Rio Olympics for the first time. So their hope for the future is their junior team. And they've invested a lot in this junior team, the coaching staff and the players, and they've worked really, really hard. I know some of the coaches. I've sat there and spoken to them in hotels, and I know how much time they've dedicated to these young men. And the thing is, if that's the case, if you, as you say, that there are people in India going, we don't want them in India because it's Pakistan and the rivalry is that, it's very short-sighted, because the one thing the world wants to see is India play Pakistan, and they want Pakistan to be competitive so that it is a cracking game. Because when those two play head-to-head and they play each other and they're both at their best, that is one of the best sights you will ever see.
I can't imagine that you wouldn't fill any stadium in India with a test between India and Pakistan. What a marketing joy it would be to have India playing Pakistan. Listen to those cash registers ting, ting, ting away. And to think that they're just going to wash them away like that is just incredible. I mean, we're always told about how much the Indian cricket goes after the cash dollar, and I'm sure hockey's the same. Why wouldn't you be jumping on that? The greatest rivalry in hockey is India and Pakistan.
I also think that I would like to see, personally, after maybe the dust has settled, an investigation into what exactly has happened. I think, A, Pakistan deserve that. I think, B, you know, even their players and fans would want to know if it was the Pakistan Hockey Federation who screwed up. Was it the bureaucracy of the Indian people supplying the visas? You know, the scary thing for me, though, is, and I'm on social media with some of the players from Pakistan, and there's a lot of accusations flying around at the moment. Of course, we must say unsubstantiated at this point in time, accusing India of all sorts of things. But the one that scared me the most was one player saying that when they played in the Asian Champions Trophy, a Malaysian player told him that Malaysia would be playing at the Junior World Cup. Now, Malaysia didn't qualify for the Junior World Cup. So I'm thinking, if that accusation, and that came from a player, then that is serious, because that was a competition held 6 weeks ago. And you think, well, or five, 6 weeks ago. And you think, how would Malaysia have known then? And then that would explain why they've probably got their visas already.
Well, what I find it interesting is that obviously there's a great deal of enmity between Pakistan and India, the political and social level even. They've asked another Muslim country to come and join the tournament. And I find quite interesting. I mean, it's such a mucked up, messy little situation, because there is this overhanging political agenda over the top of it any time you talk about India, Pakistan. And for God's sake, I don't care if you're Muslim or if you're Hindu or if you're bloody Jedi. Get over your religion, get over yourselves. Honestly.
It's sport.
It's sport. I don't care which god you believe in when you play hockey.
No, I have to agree. And just wrapping up the world of hockey, of course, the Kookaburras played their series in Melbourne at the International Festival of Hockey, came out on top there. And that was a good result, because there were a lot of young faces. All the players over, I think it was the age of 28, were rested. And so all the young boys had a chance to step up and play in that. And, of course, the women came out in the end on top against India in the Test series. They lost the first Test, which was a bit of a blow to the hockey ruse, but they fought back and ended up winning the next two.
Yeah, it's some good grounding for the youngsters. Was it a full hockey ruse squad?
No, again, they brought in a lot of new faces. Oh, some girls who'd been part of the program, gone back over east. And again, there were one or two that you felt really stepped up. I still think that the hockey roos are just lacking something. Like, there's just, to me, the connection between the midfield and the attack just isn't quite there at the moment. And it must have been hard for them, because interim coach, same as the Kookaburras had an interim coach. And there were a lot of the people who have put their hand up for the coaching roles were in Melbourne for second interviews, so everybody knew who was there and why they were there. So yeah, that was very interesting. It's going to be interesting to see who will be announced. I believe a Hockey Roos coach will be announced very shortly. A decision has been made.
Well, that, I mean, they've known that was coming for a while.
Yeah.
Regardless of the fact Evan Collins left just after the Olympics for whatever reasons he happened to leave for, or was sacked, or whatever people want to say about that situation. But
yeah.
So they had an idea that that was coming anyway. They were probably part of the way down that journey.
Exactly.
But the men, I don't think, were necessarily expecting it.
No, and Paul Gordoyne, of course, was interim coach for the men during that series
as well.
You reckon
there's a chance at the top one?
I believe he's put his hand up for the women's job.
Okay.
So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see how he goes. There are some people saying that, you know, they need a complete overhaul and maybe the men need a foreign coach. I do know that one foreign coach was asked, and he said, if you want me to come offer me the job, I'm not attending an interview. He goes, but if you're coming to me saying you want me as your coach, then yes, I will talk to you. But he goes, it's not, you're the ones approaching me. I've not applied for the job.
Oh, well, don't offer it to him.
He goes, if I've applied for it, then I'll have an interview. But if you're coming to me.
Well, no worries, mate. See you later. Goodbye.
Yeah.
That's easy.
I mean, what's your thoughts? I mean, because.
Why do we need an overseas coach? I'm not against an overseas coach at an ideological level, but I'm not sure that we need one.
Well, and this was interesting because this is an argument put forward to me by some of the playing group. Was, you know, we've been with an Australian coach now. We've won one gold medal. Maybe we need a little bit of an input from an outsider to just maybe tweak something and a fresh approach in that, you know, the hockey program has run along the same tram line, if you like, for a number of years. And they just felt maybe an outsider coming in could freshen it up, may tweak a few things, and that could be the difference. Because Australia's still in the rankings a long, long way in the men's game at number one, and they win everything, but it's that Olympic Games is the one stumbling block.
You know, when you look back over past coaches, they all come through the Hockey Australia system, and they've all been there for a long time. Maybe they don't necessarily need to go for an overseas-born coach, but maybe an overseas-based coach who's still an Australian. Maybe it's Terry Walsh, who's been in other setups and seen other things. I mean, he's coached in India as well, hasn't he, Terry?
Yeah, he was coaching, and he's currently the director of coaching or technical director in Malaysia.
Yeah. So he's been around and seen other coaching setups and been around other and would have seen stuff that. He'd seen work in Australia, not working overseas, or stuff that didn't work in Australia, actually working somewhere else. Maybe it's someone like him.
No, I think you raise a really valid point there. And
the other thing to be careful of is the bloody language difficulties. It's no good going, oh, Bjørn Müller is the greatest hockey coach ever born if he doesn't speak a word of English, because that will just be a disaster. Communication is one of the most important things.
No, I agree with you there, and I'm sure that they would realise that one. But I agree with you about the Australian coaches who've gained experiences in other areas. I think there's a lot to be said for that. And, of course, you know, if you look at Colin Batch, who's currently the coach of the Black Sticks, he is coached in Belgium as well. And a lot of people are saying the reason Belgium are where they are is the work that he did there. Of course, Adam Commins, though, had been in Belgium and he came back. So then there's an argument, well, did that succeed? Did it not? I don't know. We'll have to leave the jury out.
And remember, a coach's results are only going to be as good as his players are.
Yeah.
And that makes it very difficult to judge coaches as well. You know, what sort of job did Adam do? Well, you know, consider where they were when he picked them up. Where do they finish? Yeah. They had a couple of good results. I mean, they won a World Cup.
And he got them up to number two in the rankings. So, you know, I think he did a good job, but I do think he took that group as far as they could go.
Yeah, that's probably about it. And that was the result from Rio. And once again, I'm still hearing idiots on Eastern States broadcast talking about the disappointment and how disappointing the Australian hockey is and disappointed. Get over yourselves, boys. Tell you what, go and find out the truth. Go and watch some international hockey and get some knowledge before you sprout an opinion.
Hi, I'm Nicholas Jacobi from Germany, playing for the Delhi Wave Riders. You're hearing Not the Footy Show.
Anyway, it's probably time for us to turn our attention to our guest on this show. And we're now going to talk golf and the World Super 6, which is going to be a world's first. It's being held at Lake Karanup course, 16th to the 19th of February. And it promises to be a really intriguing event because it's a format that's never been seen before. There'll be 156 players, massive amount of prize money, $1.75 million up for grabs, so huge amount of money. But rather than me prattle on about it, we're going to hear from a man behind it, and that is Nathan Caddack. Nathan Caddack, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, we're talking today because the World Super 6 Golf is coming to Perth in February. Now, it's a new concept. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came about and also maybe how it's going to work?
Well, it's a brand new event, world first, as you mentioned, co-sanctioned by the European Tour. But what the exciting part of it is, it's a brand new format. Obviously, most tournaments standard four rounds of stroke. So we have a bit of a twist leading into our Super Sunday, where you'll have your traditional cut on the Friday night, and then there'll be a second cut on the Saturday evening to cut the group down to 24 players. Now, these 24 players will play over six holes, a featured match play event, going head-to-head until we have one winner at the end of the day.
Wow, and what's the sort of feedback from the players? Because that's something very, very different.
Look, I think the players are very curious. A lot of them like the traditional stroke event, but they also like something a little bit different, and that's why I think it's a great fit for Perth that we can provide a world-first event that's new. I suppose they're looking at it as the big bash of golf, and I think Perth is a really good fit for the event.
You mentioned the players are looking for something different, and I would have thought it could get a bit of a sort of treadmill effect the way the tour works. So this could, do you see them having a bit of fun, or do you think they're going to be taking it pretty seriously too? Because what's the prize money?
Well, it will actually be the biggest purse in Australia, so they will be taking it fairly seriously. But I think also the Big Bash started as a bit of fun, but it's become very important within the cricket calendar. So I think this will also have that same feel. Maybe a little bit of fun at first, but I think when it gets down to the pointy end of the tournament, I think the guys will be taking it pretty seriously. And having 50% of the group from the European Tour and 50% from the Australasian Tour, you know, there might even be a little bit of rivalry when those match play events start coming out on the Sunday.
And are there world ranking points up for grabs as well?
Absolutely. So fully-fledged tournament. So it, once again, will add to the seriousness of the event itself.
Who came up with the concept?
Very good question. I'm not even sure myself, but I'm patting them on the back because it's something I think golf needs. To really open up to a wider audience.
I'm sure it does. And I mean, you mentioned that it's part of the European Tour, that they've obviously really embraced it because they used to have the event down here at Caronup and that's no longer there. So was it a case of they still wanted a presence in Australia?
Well, the PGA specifically didn't run the Perth International. It was run by a company called IMG. So this is a new event being run by the PGA. So they really know how to... They're putting on a club championship on the Gold Coast at the moment, and they really know how to run a good event, so we're quite excited that PGA is part of the Perth event for this coming year.
And Lake Caronup is the chosen course again. Were there other courses that bid for the event?
Not that I'm aware of, but we're very, very happy that it's at Lake Caronup. You know, it's in the top 10 golf courses in Australia. A lot of the tour players really enjoy coming to the course to play. So it ticks a lot of boxes. So it's we're very happy that's where it's being played.
I would think as well, having hosted other events, they know how to do a good event.
Absolutely, absolutely. So we're hoping to bring a few new things that people might not have seen at the Perth International. And being that it's the type of format that it's providing, we're hoping to show a few little things you might not see at your everyday golf tournament.
Now, I'm sure there are general admission tickets, but are there other packages if people like want to come as a group of friends or even a corporate package? How's it going to work?
Yeah, we wanted to provide a few different options for people depending on what type of experience they want at the golf tournament. So there will be your standard general admin, but we also have the Super Terrace facility, and that will be a marquee that will sit between the 11th green and the 12th tee box. So we'll actually have dual views from that facility, and that's coming in at a $95 price point. Yeah, so middle of Feb, you've got your aircon facility, you've got your seating, we'll provide a light lunch and your drink on arrival, so, and there'll be a cash bar facility there as well. So a really good option if you just want to do a little bit more than just your normal general admin.
Now that's a really good, and that's not a bad price when you look at a lot of sporting events today.
Absolutely. Look, end of the day, the PGA wants people to come to the event. Because we know it will promote the game, and that's what the PGA is all about, as well as looking after the golf professionals as well.
And I'm sure there are corporate marquees as well, aren't there?
Yeah, if you wanted to do something a little bit nicer and a bit more all-inclusive, we do have a corporate marquee on the 18th green as well, so that's going to be your prime location for viewing. And in addition to that, obviously a lot of the matches that go down to the 18th, that's where you want to be. So we have something at the $295 price point, and that's going to be, you know, your six-hour food and drink package, your special guests, best seat in the house, a tight package. And the one thing I didn't mention before is one of the new things that we're bringing to the tournament is a sudden death hole. So any matches that will be tied after the six-hole match play, there's a little 80-metre hole that we've created. It plays to the 18th green. So if you're tied after six, you go to the sudden death hole. You play it once, and if you're still tied after that hole, you go play it again, and then it's nearest the pin, takes it out. So it's quite unique that we have a product in golf. Usually if you have a shot to win an event, if you happen to miss it, you know, you obviously, well, it'll be a playoff and you play it again. Same as if you had a putt to stay in it. If you miss, you lose.
Yeah.
Whereas we're actually going to have a situation where you have a shot that if you make the shot, you win it. And if you miss the shot, you lose. And that's quite unique. Golf doesn't usually have that situation. So it's probably one of the most things I think I'm excited about to create that situation on a golf course.
You mentioned on the last day, it's obviously six holes. How difficult has it been to decide which six holes are going to be the ones that are played, or could that vary, and are the players told that at the start of the tournament?
Yeah, the six holes are predetermined, and we know what they are already. So it's a case of getting a good balance of holes, but also functional throughout the 18-hole layout.
And I presume they're a mixture, are they? They're not all sort of par threes. There's a par four, par five.
Yeah, certainly a bit of a mix. But they'll start from the first. The 11th and 12th, where I mentioned the marquee, that essentially is the fourth and fifth hole of the match play. So once again, a lot of action will be around those areas. And the 18th is the sixth and final hole in the match play.
Have you got any of the players signed up already? I mean, do we know some of the names coming?
Nothing to be announced quite yet. Hopefully early December we'll actually have it all finalised. So all the talks are happening now. But there are going to be certainly some world-class golfers in there, and the field itself is going to be very strong.
Did the PGA consult with the players about the concept and sort of say, look, how do you feel about this? It's going to be something different. Do you want to be a part of it? Was it very much that approach?
Look, I think there's a lot of talk between the European Tour, PGA, players about doing things a little bit differently. So I think on the most part, people are pretty open to try new things. So that's probably the overall feeling of it.
As a new event, and as you said, it's unique to Perth, it's unique in the world, do you think you're going to get a lot of media attention from it, and that the sort of golfing aficionados are all going to come down and say, we want to have a look at this?
We hope so. The Perth International used to do very well all over the world in terms of its ratings. So we're thinking by bringing something new to the table, I think if you do like your golf anywhere in the world, this is going to be an event worth watching.
Absolutely. And as you say, there may be that rivalry, European and Australasian as well, which just adds a little bit of spice to it.
Just a little bit extra spice, possibly, yes. I'm sure there'll be a lot of West Australians cheering on the local boys.
Absolutely. Now, tickets, we mentioned obviously the various packages. When do they go on sale if people want them?
You can get the corporate hospitality stuff as of now, and there will be an announcement when the general admin stuff will be available.
And through the corporate, do they contact the PGA here?
Contact the PGA office and they will get you in touch with the appropriate people. The website is www.worldsuper6perth, and the hospitality options are on that website.
Well, Nathan, fantastic catching up, and let's hope it is a brilliant event. How long is it signed up for at the moment?
We've got it for 3 years, so it's here to stay. And I'm very confident that we're going to build this event year on year, and you know, I think it's going to be here to stay. It's going to be, I think, not only a big event on the Australian calendar and the Perth calendar, but hopefully also the world calendar.
We're not going to let the Victorians steal it after 3 years, are we?
I wouldn't have thought so. We're pretty proud here in Perth. So when we get something going, we run with it as long as we can.
No, fantastic. Let's hope it's the Hotman Cup of Golf.
And even more so, hopefully. Yes.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for your time. Cheers.
This is Sugar Ray Leonard, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Well, that was Nathan Caddick, and hopefully you got the idea of how this tournament's going to work. The final round on the Sunday, the tournament becomes just a six-hole match play. And if any match is all square, then all the competition after the completion, rather, of the six-hole, it will be decided by a knockout hole. And that's going to be really interesting. And the winner is the last man standing in the match plan. I think that's going to be a really attractive final day of a golf tournament.
Can I stick my hand up here?
Yeah.
I'm not a golfer. I'm not a fan of the game. Okay, people know that. I'm not. But golf is a much, much loved sport across the globe. So you can't deny that it has a special... For me, personally, I can't deny that it has a special place for people, etc. And what a great tournament. For golfers, that sounds like a bloody brilliant weekend.
Well, I think it's just going to make it a little bit interesting. And, I mean, apparently the players wanted... The great thing is the players, after missing out on the tournament that was at Lake Cannet before, I've forgotten what it was called... my mind's gone blank.
Not Johnny Walker Classic.
Well, there was that one, but it wasn't that, no. Anyway, that finished, and they wanted to still come back and play in Perth, and that's why this tournament has been created. They loved coming to Western Australia. And I think having, as Nathan says there, almost like a Hopman Cup of golf, that here is a unique tournament. Hopefully it'll bring in the best players who'll want to have a go at it.
Yep, and good luck to them. I mean, like I say, I'm not a great golf fan by any stretch, but... It's all promoting sport, and it's all promoting WA, and it'll hopefully bring in some dollars as well.
And, yeah,
we need them at the moment.
Hopefully it'll grow over time. So I think that's really exciting, and I wish them all the very best with it.
It's always been disappointing that Perth hasn't been able to maintain a top-flight golf tournament. I mean, Melbourne does it easily, and they maintain two or three. Sydney does it easily, and it's just disappointing that... We've got great golf courses here, from what I'm led to believe by golfers. Our courses are great.
There's too much rough and too many bunkers for me, but anyway.
That's got more to do with your driving than the golf course, doesn't it? But, you know, it'd be great to see a lot of work that goes in around the golfing community here rewarded with a tournament that stays here, something like that, that's just going to be here and it's going to be here for a long time.
No, absolutely. Now... Probably just before we come to the end of this podcast, we have to talk about the farce that the National Premier Leagues of WA has become at the end of 2016. And for anyone that loves the game of football, it's a very, very sad state of affairs. For those of you who don't know what's happened, so at the end of the season, there is a criteria in which teams have to meet to be in the National Premier Leagues of Western Australia. Football West sent an email to Joondalup United, who were in top of the league going into the final game, and basically said, these are the 4 points you need to meet to be accepted into the National Premier Leagues next season. So they complied before the end of the season, and they actually won their game. Mandurah City were told, if Joondalup don't meet that criteria, you will play off with the bottom place team, which is Subiaco United. And it will decide a home and away game. Who wins on aggregate will be the team that comes up because they met the criteria. So everything's accepted. Joondalup win. Joondalup are told by Football West they won the league. Subiaco United, Football Club told them not to. They said, Football West, I think you're jumping the gun here. Because in the actual rules of competition, I think it's 6 or 7 criteria must be met before a team is promoted. And one of those is producing a financial report. Well, seeing as 2 of the committee at Joondalup United are actually chartered accountants, that one wouldn't have been too hard. But again, Football West had told them that they didn't need to produce that until the end of their first season. So they'd had conversations, which means that the staff of Football West did not even understand the rules of their own competition. And so Subiaco lodged a complaint and said, look, we don't believe they do meet the criteria because there's 7 points, not 4, as you've basically said to them. Football West took legal advice. They saw their normal lawyers who said, you don't have a case at all. We suggest you just cave in. In the same instant, they went to another lawyer who I believe from a source in Subiaco basically tried to say, if you take this to court, you will lose and it will cost you all this money. Subiaco said, bring it on, because again, they have lawyers in their setup. And so eventually Football West had to bow down and said, okay, Subiaco, you're remaining in the National Premier League. Sorry, Joondalup, you're not coming up. Joondalup had already held trials. They'd already taken deposits from parents to guarantee that their players would be in the squads. They've obviously signed players knowing that they're going up to the top league because obviously they want to play in the top competition in WA. So now they've got to go back to those parents and hand back the money. They've also invested in a lot of things to prepare to go up into this National Premier League. Now, one of the things that is not much talked about is Subiaco, one of the reasons they don't want to go down is because they had one of the biggest junior setups. Now, this was one of the reasons when I was against the NPL in the first place, was in the Netherlands, one of the reasons it failed and was abandoned after three seasons was because when teams got relegated, everyone had said, your child needs to be part of an NPL or the equivalent in the Netherlands team if it has any hope of playing in the A-League. So the minute a team's relegated, all those kids leave. Now, I know Subiaco were worried that they were going to lose large numbers of their juniors, and a lot of their financial planning is based on the numbers in the juniors. So, again, the financial implications to their club for being relegated are huge, and they had to protect that. Now, Subiaco is getting criticised for challenging Football West, but my argument there is I actually think they've done the right thing. If you look at the committee, your job on a committee is to defend your or do the best things for your club at all times. I don't agree with them morally in that I believe the team that wins promotion on the football pitch should be the team that is promoted. But this is the mess that we've got into now, in that when you put criteria on teams and that their promotion is based on things that are off the pitch and not to do with football.
Well, I remember having a discussion with you some time ago about the merits of whether Subiaco should be in the NPL. And it looks like the fears are now true, in that, you know, Subiaco were never a strong club at the senior level, were they?
No.
Strong in juniors?
Weren't. Yep.
Okay. Well, that's what happens when you're not a strong senior club. You get relegated. And if Subiaco, the committee at Subiaco, didn't have that in the back of their mind when they were doing their planning, then they were silly and foolish. Because they should have realised that relegation is a chance. It's a chance for every team in that sport. Okay, and so they've got to hold it a bit on themselves as well. Well, we should have thought about this. We should have thought this was going to be a possibility. And I'm sure that there would have been members of that committee that knew they were going to struggle at NPL level and that they were a chance to be relegated. So part of me says for Subiaco, well, you know, oh, we're going to lose all our juniors because... Mate, that was always on the cards. That's not happening because of this situation. That's happening because you don't have a strong senior side to your club and you're not good enough to be playing at that level, your seniors.
It's very hard to argue against exactly what you're saying. And this is.
I feel sorry for him, but that is where you are at.
Yeah, and it goes back to, again, a discussion that we had when this wasn't a podcast and it was on air, that the whole application process, again, in my opinion, was heavily flawed, in that you had two board members and a CEO were part of the assessment panel. Two of those board members had associations with two of the clubs applying to be in the NPL. Not only that, they had offered advice and guidance to clubs that were putting their applications together, as had the CEO. Now, the CEO at a meeting at Stirling Lions Football Club had said to all the clubs in attendance that there would be independent people on that assessment panel. And there weren't. There were board members and a CEO. So to me, it was heavily flawed. It needed to be judged by independent people from outside the football community, or even people from the football community over east come over and actually sit there, who have no history with any of the clubs, and it was done on merit. Because the big feeling was with many of the people is it was not done on merit. Now, the other thing, the rod that Football West have made for their own backs now is, are they going to now police every single club on all of the criteria to be in the NPL? Now, I know one club that is in debt, and I've been told this by someone at that club, that they owe around $70,000. Now, Football West are saying they're meant to be checking the finances of all the clubs on a regular basis. If they're $70,000 in debt, why are they still in the NPL? Because they are a risk in terms of paying players and a whole lot of other things. So if you look at the rules of the competition, that club should no longer be in the NPL and should be thrown out as well. And maybe Joondalup United could take their place. But they've got to now police the rules that are there.
What I find so staggering in all of this, that at the beginning of the season, this wasn't all known.
Yeah, exactly. And this is one of the points I've said is that everybody knows the criteria to be in the NPL. Why did Football West not create a form or a spreadsheet where they go around every club in the first division and go, okay, you're not meeting this. You have till this date, this season, to comply with that, because if you win the league, so even if you made it the halfway point in the season, so you're giving them 3 months in which to actually...
Why wouldn't you do it at the beginning of the season? Why wouldn't you, every club have been sent a letter from Football West saying, of course, as you all realise, at the end of this season, there will be promotion and relegation to the NPL. If you're outside of the NPL wishing to be promoted to the NPL, these are the criteria you must meet by this date. Now, that should be at the beginning of the season, halfway through.
Totally agree. But what I think is, if Football West should be going out and assessing that, and they should then give them the club, say, okay, you meet this, you meet this, you meet this. You don't meet this, but we're going to give you, say, until the 1st of June to be compliant. And both of them, club and Football West, sign it, and then it's reassessed on the 1st of June. So that then, because there might be teams who have come up from the second division, John, like Fremantle City have come up this year. They're a club that's going places at the moment. There's a good chance that they will be competitive this year. Are they ready to meet the NPL requirements? I don't know. But, you know, having come up from the second, if suddenly they're knocking on the door of the NPL in their first season in Division 1, they might not meet all the criteria. So I think it's only fair they're given a little bit of time.
Oh, absolutely. And this idea that halfway through the season you get a memo saying, oh, well, these are the four criteria. I mean, what's going on at Football West when you have a statuted seven criteria or whatever it is?
The rules, yeah, I think it's 7 points.
But rules are rules are rules. They don't just suddenly change halfway through the season.
But this is, again, and it goes back to an issue that I have, is that we have at board level the board not complying with the laws of Australia. So we have appointed board members, one appointed board member. Now, it says in the Constitution, appointed board members can only be there for 2 years, then they must 2-year terms. We've got one who's there for 4 years now. He's been there for 4 years as an appointed board member. We have another one who was appointed 2 years ago, but they don't tell you on their website or even in their annual report the month in which that person was appointed. So basically, by the end of this month, her term could have finished already, but she's still there, and you have another one whose term runs out in January. So again, if they're not abiding by the rules at board level, how are they going to make sure that the people that are paid to administer the game are actually doing things correctly? And this is where the whole thing's falling apart. Then we have the standing committees, who are the most powerful people in the game, who have the ability to vote board members on and off. They also have the power to make rule changes within the competition. Yet the people that are on the standing committees do not understand their responsibilities or the power that they have. And as the former CEO said to me, it's not in the administrator's interest to have them functional.
Well, it's obvious the Department of Commerce has to get off its arse and go and do its job. Having been someone that's been, I hate to use this term, victim of lack of corporate governance, what's going on at Football West is illegal and a disgrace, and it falls directly under the banner of the WA Department of Commerce. Now, the people in the Department of Commerce, as far as I can tell, don't do anything. They are the regulators for this. They are the ones that are supposed to be going, hang on, you don't do this, we're going to deregister you if you do this, or we're going to take this action. It's all there in legislation. They can do it. So it's about time they got off the big fat round ones and went and did their jobs, because the Department of Commerce has sadly, sadly been lacking when it comes to corporate governance in this state.
Well, the sad thing for me is Football West have come out saying that they will change the rules. They will be reviewing the rules for 2017. The biggest problem is Football West are saying they're going to change those situations. If you read the Constitution, they cannot make a change to the rules to the NPL because it is a national Premier League's competition, which is overseen by the FFA. So they cannot make any changes to the competition here in WA without the approval of the FFA. Now, are the FFA going to approve the changes they want? Who knows? But at the moment, they can't be going out there saying, we're going to make these changes, because they've still got to be sure that the FFA will approve any changes they table. It's a mess.
It's going to stay a mess too until someone who's in a position of responsibility sticks their hand up and kicks some butt.
And I'm sorry, John, yes, I don't advocate people losing their jobs, but people have cost clubs money here and they need to be held accountable. And somebody needs to be held accountable and put up and said, yeah, this is the person who screwed up.
What irritates me is people trading off being a board member of this or being a board member of that or doing this, rah, rah. And actually, they've done a terrible job. They've done an absolutely shocking, shocking job. And a lot of people on the Football West board, I wouldn't be telling people publicly that I was on the Football West board because look, there's your track record right there.
Well, it's the same, John, with the standing committees. And I was really pleased to see somebody make this comment on social media. The standing committees, as I said, they have the ability to vote people onto the board. So they should be keeping minutes of their meetings, which they haven't done, which I've been banging on about this for a long time. But the other thing is they should not be taking any freebies from Football West, because these are the people that are keeping Football West accountable. So they should not be taking a free ticket as a standing committee member to the gold medal awards night, because that is a gift and they are in a position of influence where that gift could be deemed to have influenced a decision they made. You know, they should not be going in the VIP areas at finals, games and whatever. They need to stand independent. Or if they're going to take any of these gifts, they need to be minuted so anybody can see what the gift was, why it was given and whether it was deemed appropriate or not. But they need to be above all suspicion or accusation, and they cannot take those things. And I think this is the sad thing, is people nowadays, and I'm not just saying in football, in all sports, seem to put themselves up for these positions because of the freebies they will get from holding that position.
Let's face it, the corporate world in Australia is a boys' club. They go from one failure to the next failure to the next failure and take their multi-million dollar checks with them, and it's disgraceful.
It is indeed. And if that was, that's sad just in the way it's being run, but I mean, we should just mention how sad.
No, you go. You
keep... well, I was just going to mention how sad it was, the plane crash in Brazil. Chapecoense, you know, losing pretty much their whole team. Any plane crash is tragic, and any family that loses any relatives in that. But I mean, the football team, it just brings it to light because sport is such a big thing.
You know, it's a terrible event, and it's people have lost their lives, but the ones I really feel for are the people left behind.
Absolutely.
Once you're dead, you're dead, and there's not much you can do about it. But, you know, as we've seen, there's a young child, 2 weeks old, that's been half orphaned and lost their father. Those are the stories that will hurt for a long, long time to come.
Absolutely.
Well, just before we go, I mean, that's a terrible, sad night to finish on. This morning, overnight, Jack Bobridge has announced his retirement from cycling. 27 years old. He's sadly a sufferer of rheumatoid arthritis that has finally got too much for him, so to speak. He's decided to call it quits on cycling. 3-time Olympian. 4 Commonwealth gold medals. He's a world track champion, a world cycling champion, world championship. Fantastic career, and it's sad that it had to come to an end when it did, but mate, you got everything out of you could, Jack. Great.
Absolutely,
champion.
And I hope he doesn't suffer too much with the arthritis in years to come.
The print story that I read earlier was saying that after the Olympics, he cut back his training, and he's off his meds now. So that's a really good sign that, you know, maybe with a bit of a normal life, inverted commas, that, you know, he'll be able to maintain himself in a much better way.
Absolutely. Well, we hope you've enjoyed all the podcasts for 2016, and we wish everybody a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, and we'll definitely be back in 2017, won't we, John?
We will.
Some people are on the pitch. They think it's all over. It is.
See ya. We'll be back next week.